William is sitting in the back seat of a black car on the way to the Nepenthe clinic. The car they've sent is electric. He's still adjusting to the strange lack of sound. The driver, too, is silent. William supposes that in this line of work, it's difficult to make conversation. You can't ask people about their holidays, for example, in case they're off to wipe the memory of a holiday disaster. Nor can you turn on the radio in case it plays "Don't You Forget About Me" or "A Night to Remember" or something. He tries not to yawn, not to have that be the only sound in the car. He's hardly slept for the past 72 hours, benzos being one of the prohibitions on the long not-to-do list that Nepenthe gave him, along with alcohol, prescription drugs, illegal drugs, herbal remedies, caffeine, and any activity that might result in something colliding with his head. William's head has never been so well looked after. Still, it feels awful, both wired and fuzzy, alert and slow. It's turning into a sunny day. It was drizzling in hassocks when William left. He wonders if it's drizzly there still. Thinks of Annetta in the wet grey morning, waking the kids up. A kiss for each of their foreheads. School bags waiting downstairs by the door. William tries not to think about them. It's that superstitious fear that if he thinks about them too much, he'll lose them. Don't look back. That's how the wisdom goes. Even if you can't hear their footsteps behind you, don't turn round. Not until you're safe on the other side. A couple of days ago, Annetta came over without the kids. "To talk," she said. The sun was going down behind her, a tangerine glow over the chimneys. William very much did not want to talk, but he wanted to be near her just as powerfully. He welcomed her in, and she went around the house curiously, touching things, as if being there was as strange for her as it was for him. She didn't say anything. Her fingertips ran over photograph frames and sofa arms, and he couldn't read her expression. "I want to go with you," she said. "No," he said, before he could think of a "because." "Because," he began. "Look, William," she said, "you don't want support, I get it, but what if you come out of there and it turns out you do need it?" "Hmm," said William. He personally wasn't sure what past William, once he was back, might want. Annetta had seated herself on the chair opposite him in a way that looked temporary, thighs half on, half off the seat. Now she came and sat beside him on the sofa. He caught her perfume. She smelled like the Annetta of nights out and babysitters waiting at home, of getting drunk too quickly because they were out of practice, of sex in hotels, one ear out for a tapping at the door between the rooms. "Anyway," she said, suddenly brisk, so that all William's inappropriate thoughts went scurrying out of sight, "are you on meds or anything yet?" William explained the list of 72-hour prohibitions. In the same awkwardly matronly tone, Annetta calculated the hours they had before William had to start protecting his brain. Then she said they had about 3 left for a glass of wine. When the bottle of wine was gone, Annetta's briskness and awkwardness fell away. William saw it happen. She put down her glass, inhaled. Then there was a moment, like a little shrug, and they were gone. In the window, the sun was gone too. Annetta smiled and leaned forward. She said, "Please tell me sex wasn't on that list." At the clinic, William speaks to various people, one after another. He's being very careful. He knows that if he tests positive for madness, they won't restore his memory. He's avoiding mentioning his dad, his suspicions about his own mental stability. He can't avoid the subject of his recent application for a memory wipe, though. When he's asked about it, he admits to a few PTSD symptoms. To throw them off the scent, he wonders aloud if perhaps his previous wipe went wrong somehow. At which point everyone gets very defensive. "That is highly unlikely," says the psychologist. "These other symptoms you have sound like a completely separate issue." And with that, the handing over of William from person to person comes to a conclusion. The psychologist leaves, and William sits with his secrets intact in another white room on a reclining white couch thing next to a computer. "Won't be a moment," says the nurse. "Everything okay?" "Yes," says William, because what else is he supposed to say? In the end, William told Annetta that he didn't want her to come with him. He told her several times, in fact, as she argued with him rationally and calmly for about half an hour, then stopped abruptly, gave up, and cried. "I'm sorry," he said, wondering if she even actually heard him saying "I'm sorry" anymore, or if, with overuse, he's wrung all the meaning out of it, pared it down to a string of phonemes, I, M, S, or E. Annetta left at midnight, so she wouldn't have to explain to Milo and Fiona and her mother why she'd slept in her own house that night. Her leaving was a desolate thing. Then, the next morning, William found the fractal T-shirt had got into the wash accidentally. He hadn't meant it to, and now there was nothing of her inside it anymore. He didn't know why this bothered him so much. It wasn't like she'd died and that T-shirt was all he had. She was half an hour away, for God's sake. He could call her and she'd answer. But he picked it out of the washing machine drum, and the sadness came on slowly, in low pulses. "William?" Someone standing in front of him, the nurse. "How are you doing, William?" she says, smiling at him. "Are you ready?"
"I'm ready,"
he says. What else can he say? She hands him a cup. He drinks. The way the memory hits, it's like it happened just a moment ago. In a way, he supposes that's true. William is walking down a street. And not just that, it's everything. It's remarkable how much detail there is. The waft of bonfires in the air, the slippy layers of chestnut leaves under his shoes. His smart leather shoes with no traction whatsoever. The sky, a ludicrous sherbet pink, deepening to red nearer the roofline. It's 11:30, and William's slightly drunk. His feet fumble along the uneven paving stones, almost but never quite tripping. He's humming Sinatra songs. He's just had dinner, sushi, with Annetta, and he loves her. Not that he's told her that yet. He loves her. He's mouthing the words. Maybe he's more drunk than he thought. He mainly wants to hear how they feel. A drop of the jaw, tongue to the roof of the mouth, top teeth resting on bottom lip, a final push of air. I love you. He meant to say it to Annetta tonight, but was hesitant and hadn't found a good moment. Really, he'd prefer to text it to her. Live you. Or maybe shout it at her window, then run away. That way, if she doesn't feel the same, it's easier on both of them. Still, Annetta introduced him to her mum a couple of weeks ago. That must mean something. It certainly did to Judy, who asked him about his job and prospects as if he were a 1950s teenager. Then she'd made him take some food home. It was clear from the way she offered it that she thought William had no food in his house. He tried to tell her he did, but she cut him off. "Supermarket ready meals," she said, in a tone of deep reproach. "You bachelors and your ready meals. But now you have food." "Thanks for putting up with her," Annetta said afterwards, apologizing. "You were great. You have more patience with her than I do." "I can't actually eat ready meals," William said, "which is inconvenient. I'm mildly allergic to them. There's something in one of the preservatives they use that makes my lips swell up." "Don't tell her that," Annetta said. "You'll break her heart." William would like to bring out some parents of his own for Annetta to meet, but it's a bit early to take her to the nursing home to meet his mum. Maybe he could show her his dad's record collection, which has been sitting in storage since he died. A lot of them are rare. Billie Holiday, Sinatra, Johnny Cash's first LP. Annetta seems to like old music. But that's not the same as liking old records. Maybe she'd be unimpressed. Maybe he could take her away for a weekend instead. Yes, that's actually a great idea. Rome, maybe. Venice. His perennial failure to fit words to feelings wouldn't be so noticeable in a gondola. He could let the city do the romancing for him. William turns towards his own road. He hears two teenage boys talking and laughing up ahead. They're messing around, jumping up onto the bollards along the road, slipping and half-jumping, half-falling back down. One balances for a triumphant second before having to bail. The smell of weed drifts over to William. It reminds him of university. He finds himself gazing at the two boys with nostalgia. They're calling an end to their own night now. One boy answers a phone call, waves to the other, slouches off. His laughter fades out as he rounds the corner. The other boy leans on the bollard for a moment, looking at his own phone. He gets something out of his pocket, a bag, possibly tobacco. William hopes the kid isn't going to skin up right there, right in front of him. He doesn't want to be a police officer today. He wants to think about summers at university and gondolas with Annetta. But the kid doesn't roll anything up. Just as William's about to pass him, he pushes himself gently off the bollard and saunters into the road, without looking, straight in front of a taxi. What William does then isn't in any way a conscious decision. His brain isn't involved. There's nothing but a klaxon in his ears. It sounds like a car horn. The sound is pure urgency. It's saying, must. You must. Must do. And so his body does. William's lying on the ground, his brain coming back to awareness. It fires up sludgily, like the klaxon wiped it somehow and it needs time to reboot. Why is he on the ground? His body hurts. His hands are stinging where they scraped along the tarmac. The noise of a car horn is dying in his ears. Then it comes back to him that there was a boy. The boy walked out in front of a car and William threw himself after the boy to push him out of the way, which he did, his hands punching into the boy's slender back, knocking him forward, forward, safe. He raises himself up slowly to see where the boy is. It turns out he can get onto his hands, and then his knees, and then his feet, without his body giving way. He's not in too much pain. Standing, he looks around. The taxi is a few feet away. It stopped before it reached William. The boy himself is almost on the other side of the road, lying down. He isn't moving. William hobbles over to him.
Are you okay?
He calls. The taxi driver is by his side. They reach the boy together. The kid is not okay. It's obvious. His head rests on the curb. Blood moves from this resting place outwards across the tarmac. His right hand is extended, almost as if he's reaching out for help or offering something to William. And William sees now that he does have something to offer, a bag of sweets, except most of them are scattered across the road. His face is turned away. There's an absence all around him, like a black hole, drawing in light. Not the girl, then. That girl who had never meant William any harm, except to fall in the same way as the boy fell then. He can picture her now, like the ghostly reflection of the boy. Two of them lying, two arms outstretched, two hands reaching out. Afterwards, William is cleared of any wrongdoing. The coroner's report ruled death by misadventure. The fact that William was drunk and the taxi driver was able to stop with feet to spare is hardly mentioned. The taxi driver says the boy, Michael Graham, walked out in front of him. Michael was stoned and drunk. A woman who lived in one of the houses says that the teens had been mucking about in the street all night, causing a disturbance. She'd phoned the police before about them. It was only a matter of time, in her opinion, before there was an accident. The incident doesn't even get into the press. Michael was from a family of small-scale gang members, so William's name isn't released for fear of reprisals. His boss calls him in to reassure him of that.
So that's good news, he says to William. I knew you'd be relieved.
He's looking at William like he's expecting William to shake his hand. Congratulations, thinks William. You got away with it. It's not your fault, Carey says to William. Are you listening to me? It's not your fault. You did the right thing, the person from the police welfare department says. How can you be blamed for that?
Look, son, says William's boss. Take some time off. Welfare's obviously not cutting it. Have therapy. Come back to duty once this is under control. Okay?
But therapy, which is meant to shrink William's guilt to a practical, controllable level, doesn't work. He doesn't see why he, William, is alive and well and walking around unpunished while the kid he recklessly hurled into a curbstone is dead. The therapist says that what William is experiencing is survivor's guilt. William asks how you could be said to be a survivor of yourself. The therapist says that's just semantics. The emotional effect is the same. What the fuck do you know? William says. No, he doesn't. He says, thank you. He says he feels better. He goes back to work. Are you okay, William? Some of his friends ask. He hadn't told any of them about what happened. He hadn't told Annetta either. He can't bear to. He doesn't have to. There's no overlap between William's friends in the police, Carey, and his friends outside work, so he's able to keep it to himself. But something seems to be leaking out and worrying people. Are you really okay, William? Says Annetta. There are tears in her eyes. You don't seem okay.
I know you're not better, Carey says to William. You're just pretending. When Carey says this, William sees the boy, Michael Graham, lying in the road. The generosity of that open hand, open eyes. What happened? His eyes were asking. No, they weren't. They didn't look confused, or horrified, or sad, or serene. They weren't asking or telling. They looked like all dead people's eyes look. Dead. At night, the sky is a pool of blood, and all the stars glitter in it like sour sugar crystals. William's dreams tell him to fly up into the sky and choke in it.
Don't be ridiculous, William says to Carey. I'm fine.
Yeah, right, Carey says. I've seen people like you, right before they kill themselves. Is that what you're thinking about?
What? You're out of your mind, says William.
Weren't you going to take Annetta away this spring? Carey asks.
Well, have you booked the flights? What are you doing for Easter? Name one thing that's in your diary.
I don't own a diary.
Carey shakes his head.
You can't fool me, William. That boy is on your conscience.
Listen, have you thought about a memory wipe?
What? William says. I was involved. I was the subject of an investigation. Even though I've been cleared, I can never wipe it. You know that.
Carey lowers his voice. He says,
there are other ways to get a wipe. Any wipe, under the circumstances, would be illegal, William says.
Yeah, I know, Carey says.
Why do you think I lowered my voice?
Oh, sure, William says. I could be one of those poor bastards who try to lie to the machine. The ones that don't go mad get 20 years. Hard to choose which option I'd prefer.
That's not what I mean, says Carey.
Then what? Says William.
Look, Carey says. Chief Superintendent Rathbone told me about it. There's a woman I can put you in touch with at Nepenthe. She can get you that wipe. It's not legal, obviously, but it happens. You could...
No. William turns and walks away. Carey follows him. He takes William's arm.
Listen, he says. Annetta called me.
She called you?
Yeah. Funny way to meet the love of your partner's life. She wanted to know if I knew what was wrong with you. She didn't have anyone else to ask. I could hear she was at her wit's end. She wouldn't have called me otherwise.
She's frightened for you. She loves you. Which means if you fuck things up for yourself, they're fucked for her too. Do you want her to feel the way you're feeling now?
William stares at him.
No, says Carey.
The answer is no. So stop being so fucking selfish.
William is sitting opposite Dr. Louise Nightingale. She's a composed blonde, hair up, suit uncreased. He's noticed that she speaks better than other people. Not a posh accent, though she's got one of those. It's more that she doesn't hesitate or repeat herself or say or, which is rare. They are in Louise's office in the Nepenthe building near Baker Street. The building is undoubtedly swanky, but in an ordinary way, which struck William as deeply strange. It's Monday afternoon, and people go in and out holding pret-a-manger bags or talking on their phones, just like ordinary working people everywhere. He supposes that to them, they are ordinary. Everything they do here is strange, so strangeness is ordinary. No wonder Louise Nightingale is so calm, sitting here explaining to William how they break the law.
So I don't have to lie when I describe the memory to you, he says.
No, she says. Forget all that Carol Kurtz stuff. You tell the truth. Remember, nobody will hear the content of the memory except me. The technicians and nurses aren't in the room when you tell me the memory. It won't go on your police record because it'll be filed as a personal memory. The deletion itself will be on your medical record, but not the content. Meaning, I'm the only person who would be able to report that you're trying to delete something you're not supposed to.
Okay, William says. Thank you.
No need to thank me, Louise says. You're paying me not to report it. This isn't a favor.
Right.
So, the money. The cost of the basic procedure is £4,000, which leaves the issue of accounting for the payment. For the self-informed clients, this isn't a problem. You'll just need a cover story for what you chose to forget.
I don't think I can do that, William says. I've got a girlfriend. She seems to be able to tell when I'm keeping something from her, or lying.
Then lie better, Louise says.
I don't think I can, he says. I'm sorry. I think I've wasted your time.
There's a silence. Louise looks at him for a long time. Then she sighs.
Okay, she says. I really prefer not to do this. Self-confidential is a lot more difficult. Almost everyone I do this for is self-informed.
How many people do you do this for? William asks.
Here's some advice for when you're doing something illegal, Louise says. Ask fewer questions. Otherwise, people might start wondering if it's a sting.
Oh, right, William says. Sorry, it's not. Please don't shut this down.
It's okay, Louise says. I trust Rathbone, and he trusts whoever it is that vouched for you. And I think you're asking me about numbers because you're worried that this is some shoddy under-the-counter operation that might accidentally destroy your brain. Is that right? Well, it's not. It's a very professional under-the-counter operation, and you're one of many.
Well, many self-informed procedures. I've only done a few self-confidentials, about 10 people maybe. Mainly because, like you, they're just in too sad a state for me to refuse. The main concern for me is that if I ever needed to, I can't keep track of you. Self-confidential clients tend to move to different jobs or houses or countries, and they obviously don't let me know.
You could ask Rathbone, says William. He's not going anywhere.
Louise acknowledges this with a nod.
Fine, she says.
Thank you, says William.
Don't thank me yet, says Louise.
There's the issue of money. What usually happens with the private, self-confidential clients is that Nepenthe has agreements with most of the major banks. You pay the fee out of your savings. We erase your memory of those savings as part of the procedure. Then, for a small admin fee, the bank will backdate your statements so that the money effectively vanishes. You'll also destroy any hard copies of statements, obviously. Any relevant lawyers and accountants will be notified and will sign confidentiality agreements. The information will be visible to the tax office, but nobody is allowed to tell you about that.
That makes sense, William says.
Now, I charge £10,000 on top of the Nepenthe fee. It's usually more,
but I don't think you could afford it on a police officer's wage. I'm sure you'll agree it's reasonable, given the risk I'm taking. The difficulty here is that you, as a self-confidential, would need to find the cash for this in a way you won't miss later on. Obviously, I can wipe your memory of however you get the money.
What kind of people are able to get £10,000 in cash and not notice?
Louise gives him another long stare, this one harder than the first.
Never mind, says William.
He wonders how many people Louise has helped in this way, if helped is the word. Much as he'd like to convince himself that she's some saviour figure defying an unfair system, he doubts she's doing this out of altruism. Her hair and clothes are too sophisticated for a saviour. The fact that she charges £10,000 is also not very saviour-esque.
If you want to wait and get the money together, Louise says.
It's okay, he said. My dad died and left me a record collection. It's been in storage because I didn't know what to do with it. Nobody knows I have it. I could sell it for cash. My mother died recently, so it's not like she'd know. And I haven't told Annetta about it yet. I thought I'd wait and... He stops. Louise Nightingale watches him politely.
You don't care, do you? He says.
Not really, she says. But it's good that you have a solution. I can delete your memory of what happened to the collection, of course.
You can wipe more than one memory at the same time.
In the same session, yes, it's standard. We delete the memory itself, plus your memories of requesting the removal, the interviews, etc.
Right, William says. So, that takes care of that. My dad's record collection.
There's a short pause.
Is that a problem? Louise asks.
You see, you just presented it as a solution, but now your face says that it's a problem.
No, William says. It's not a problem.
It's almost midnight when William arrives at the clinic for the removal. He can hardly make out the town of Crows Hill. It appears in spot-lit fragments, a clock face that seems to be hanging in the clouds, beech hedges glowing under lamp posts, dark shop fronts reflecting the car headlights. The clinic itself is a big white building, phosphorescent-looking, like a research base on another planet. It's lit so brightly that it's hard to see anything else. The trees are a black, rustling wall against the slightly less black sky. The ground is black, the gravel just a crunching noise under his feet. Then he gets inside, and everything black is abruptly white. He rubs his eyes. When his vision adjusts, he sees Dr. Nightingale, not Louise, he must remember, in front of him. She asks William a few questions. How was the journey? How are you feeling? With a look that warns him not to answer honestly. Come this way, Mr. Hall, Dr. Nightingale says. She leads William down a curving corridor into a white room containing a normal-looking fake wood desk and office chair and a plastic-covered bed next to a white, plastic-covered piece of machinery. Wires come out of the machine, attached at the other end to what looks like a transparent swimming cap, hanging up above the head of the bed. Along one wall, there's a long window, behind which a couple of technicians are seated at some monitors. They aren't as crisp-looking as Dr. Nightingale. One has a striped jumper visible under his lab coat. The other has a pen behind his ear. There's a hum in the air, hardly audible.
Sit here, please, Dr. Nightingale says to William.
He climbs onto the plastic chair, which hisses gently under his weight.
I, he says.
Wait, she says.
A nurse comes in, holding a cup of water and a small dish containing some pills. She hands them to William with a smile. He swallows the pills, hands the cup and dish back to the nurse, who thanks him, smiles again, and leaves. "Right," Louise says, turning to him. "What do you want to know?" William's worried that he'll finish talking about the memory, and then his first thought will be, "I hope I don't forget Annetta," and then whatever it is they're doing will wipe her too. "What happens if I think of other things by accident?" he asks. "Would they get erased too?" "Oh yes, that's a common question," Louise says. "The drug we give you is only activated when we pass an electrical current through the relevant areas of the brain. We know which areas hold the parts of the memory because they're the brightest spots. If you think about something else, it'll come up as an anomaly on the scan. As soon as that happens, the current switches off until you're back on track." "Okay," he says. "Now, I'm going to fill in some of this paperwork while you sit and wait for those pills to take effect. It'll be about half an hour, okay? Do you want a magazine or something?"
"I'm fine," William says.
He's feeling tired suddenly. He leans his head back. When he opens his eyes, Dr. Nightingale is very close.
"You fell asleep," she says.
"Sorry."
"Not a problem. Lots of people do.
Anyway, it's time."
"Okay," he says.
Dr. Nightingale presses a button and the chair starts to recline. William tries to detect the presence of drugs in his body, but he doesn't feel any different. Tired, maybe. He doesn't feel stressed or frightened. He realizes that's probably an effect of the drugs. They don't add things, they take them away. They have also taken away his headache, the slippery, seaweedy tangle in his stomach. He floats in a temperate bath, the chair flexing and creaking gently underneath him as it lowers his upper body to near horizontal. A nurse he hadn't noticed before attaches the cap to William's head. One of the technicians looks up at Dr. Nightingale. He raises a thumb.
"Okay then, William," she says. "We're going to activate the drug now. I want you to keep your mind on what happened."
A voice comes from far away. It sounds gentler, sweeter, probably softened like everything else by the drugs. It says,
"Tell me about your walk home."
William opens his eyes. He's almost surprised to see that Dr. Nightingale is gone. Years have passed. The technician in the striped jumper and the one with a pen behind his ear have been replaced by other people. There's daylight coming in, a nurse standing beside him.
"Don't try to sit up too soon," says the nurse beside him.
"How are you doing? Okay?" He can't answer. Without sitting up, he moves his eyes around the room, looking for someone from before. He doesn't recognize anyone. None of this lessens his alarm.
"Did you see my memory?" he asks the nurse. "Did anyone?"
It's not how he meant to say it, but she seems to understand.
"No, you're the only one who knows what it is," she says. She must be used to explaining this.
"Would you like some water?"
William thinks for a moment.
Where is Dr. Nightingale? Does she know he's come here for a restoration?
She can't. She'd be here too, surely, if she knew. But why doesn't she know? He's trying not to give his thoughts away. He puts on what he hopes is the expression of a typical Nepenthe patient. Then he realizes that most restoration patients probably look as panicked as William,
as stunned, as desperately calculating. He says, I need to use the loo. Is that okay? Of course. You should get up carefully, though. Take your time. And if you feel dizzy, call us. There's a button in the lavatory.
Okay, thank you.
He wants to run. He gets up slowly, forces himself to walk slowly towards the door. Not the girl in the picture, William thinks. Not that poor girl. Michael Graham. William can see him now. A figure of a person, so recently vacated. How could he have left so quickly? There was a second in which William and Michael were in close contact, a fraction of a moment of the very nearest intimacy. Then what? Then nothing. By the time William picked himself up and walked over to Michael, Michael was gone. I'm afraid Michael just left, said the sweets in the road. You just missed him, said the blood. Sorry, said the outstretched hand. As William opens the door, slowly, slowly, the nurse says, When you get back, we'll give you a brief medical check. Then Dr. De Oliveira will be here to chat to you. Not Dr. Nightingale, he asks. The technician at the computer looks up now. He looks at the nurse. Then he says, Dr. Nightingale doesn't work on individual cases any longer. At the same time as the nurse says, Dr. Nightingale is on leave. And William knows that Dr. Nightingale has been sacked. William walks down the corridor, thinking about the crimes he has committed. Crime one, killing somebody. Which was technically not a crime in the eyes of the law, not officially judged to be so. William got away with it, which is insane, because how can killing somebody ever not be a crime? William didn't mean to kill a boy, but he did kill him. He was drunk and stupid, and it turned out that a man's life was safer in the path of a moving vehicle than it was in the hands of William. He sees it clearly, the killing. Detailed, defined, like how frozen food companies claim that food is actually fresher for having been frozen, this memory is pristine from lack of handling. The girl in the picture, the boy on the road, the girl's hair, the boy's hand, holding the sweets he was about to eat, then not. This is what the word unsparing means, he thinks. Crime two, erasing the memory of killing somebody. Technically, very much a crime in the eyes of the law. Aside from the gross misconduct and tampering with neural evidence, illegally obtained memory deletions can get you 20 years. William could go to prison not for killing someone, but for forgetting that he killed someone. Not quite a life sentence, though he deserves it, doesn't he? Because a life is what he let escape when he cracked Michael Graham on the curb like an egg. And that's what everyone says, the victims. A life sentence is what my daughter got, my dad got, my wife got, what I get. So that's what the killer should get. So many different victims, yet they all believe the same thing, the same truth, life for life. William walks past the lavatories, checks behind him, sees nobody around, and continues on towards reception. The receptionist is at the desk, facing away from him, her head bent over something. Trying to look neither panicky nor casual, he walks quickly towards the door. The sudden movement makes the receptionist jump. She does a muffled, oh, when she sees him. She's halfway through a sandwich, which she knocks out of sight behind her computer. I'm just going out to make a phone call, he explains. She looks at him warily. Then she says, We have a room you can use.
I also need a cigarette, he says. I'm staying in the grounds, back in 20. They said it was okay. She says.
Okay. Sorry. It's just we've had people leaving and not coming back. We have a duty of care.
As she says this, William realizes that there's nothing the clinic can do right now to actually stop him leaving. He almost smiles at her, with the relief of it.
Thanks, he says.
He heads towards the door.
I'll be right here, Mr. Hall, she calls after him. Just press the button to come back in.
He raises his hand in a small wave. The glass doors slide open as he approaches. The security guard standing there seems absorbed in his own thoughts, head tilted up at the sky, the icy burn of the blue. As William approaches, the guard nods at him, allowing William to walk past, on through the main gate and out into the street. William starts a text message to Annetta. He tells her he loves her. He says it turned out the wipe was to do with his dad's death. He'll explain the details later. He doesn't mention Louise Nightingale. He wouldn't want her to get into trouble. He's strangely grateful to Louise for making at least a few years possible. A decent amount of happiness for a good number of years. A bargain at the price. He doesn't say sorry to Annetta. He wishes he could. He wishes he could say all kinds of things. But he's got to think about how this message will be read later. I'll be home soon, he types. Tell the kids I love them. After he sends the message, pain comes over him. It's a different sort of pain from the kind he felt under the shadow, which was final and flat and pressed the sense out of everything, like a truck tire rolling over a mouse. This misery is rich and nuanced. Complex notes, different layers, a symphony. It encompasses Annetta's t-shirt, Fiona's boyfriend's dog, Milo's ice cream sundae. It's the past. Fiona as a toddler, low-browed and ferocious. Milo as a baby, with the hiccups he got so often that they took him to the doctor, who said she'd have expected this sort of overreaction from new parents, but not from them. It's also the future. The bed in the sunlight, with his family on it. Lifting up, now. Rising into the sky like the bed in that old Disney film, and William running to get on it, even though it's too high already. But he runs and runs anyway, and finally gives up, out of breath, bent, squinting after it, smaller and smaller, until it vanishes into the light he'd liked so much. William walks until he comes to the fastest flowing part of the road. Nobody stops him. He can walk or stop. Absolute freedom of choice. He has a strange sense that he is being given a choice so that he can make the right choice. He's never really believed in redemption before. He's not sure if this is it. But that's probably the thing about redemption. You have to do it without knowing that it will work. Otherwise, it doesn't count. It was as if William hit Michael so hard he divided in two, in mid-air. His body fell to earth, his soul flew up, knocked out of the park. At the time, William was horrified at how easy it was, how effortlessly something like that could be done. It disturbed him. Now he finds it almost consoling. Here, gone. Blink of an eye. Simple as that. A woman is walking on the other side of the road, holding the hand of a child. William waits. He watches them walk round the corner until they're almost out of sight. His phone starts ringing. A lorry comes round the corner. It moves neatly, almost deliberately, in front of the receding woman and child. The lorry seems larger because of it, like it's filling the whole street, blotting out the light. There's that kind of inevitability about it. The way the sun reflects off the window of it, a flat glare, like the gaze of God, looking at William, saying, "You understand." And William says, "Yes."